welcome to the PureMed Podcast special series, Behind Diagnoses Patients. My name is Leah Sarah Pure, and I am your host. Behind Diagnoses Patients aims to uplift patient voices, to share their insight and experiences navigating the healthcare system. It welcomes everyone from patient advocates, the chronically ill, the disabled, and those with rare diseases to offer suggestions for a more equitable world. On this episode, I'm pleased to welcome Sarah Lippitt, a UK-based artist and author. Her first graphic novel, Stan and Nan, won the Quentin Blake Prize for Best Narrative at the Royal College of Art, and was published in 2016 by Jonathan Cape, becoming a Guardian bestseller and 2016 Book of the Year. Her latest autobiographical work, A Puff of Smoke, was published by Jonathan Cape in November of 2019 and was supported by an Arts Council England Literary Grant. The memoir became an Observer Graphic Novel of the Month, a Guardian Graphic Novel of 2019, and received accolades from The Herald, It's Nice That, and Eye on Design. Alongside her long-form works, Lippitt has also created socio-political reportage, comics focused on the stories of diverse communities in locations across the UK and abroad. She lectures in illustration at the University of Edinburgh and delivers talks on her practice to a variety of audiences, both in the United Kingdom and internationally. Today, Sarah, we are here for you to tell your story in a way that communicates the good and the bad of our healthcare system, your concerns and suggestions for a more equitable world. So I'd like for you to take it away and tell us about yourself, your story, what inspired you to become a powerful patient advocate.
Thank you, Leah. So I have been through quite a lot in my childhood, up until into adulthood, and continue to live with two long-term conditions. But it wasn't until recently that I decided to tell my story and share my story, realizing that the importance of sharing our own personal medical histories and experiences are really valuable to those that are going through similar things. So it was quite painful to go back and share this story, but I wanted to very much so in a form that would help young people to have hope and to have more confidence in trying to find a diagnosis for themselves. So when I wanted to tell my story, I did it through the graphic novel form, so with through drawings and writing. So now I'll sort of tell you a bit about what happened to me. So when I was born, I was born healthy, bubbly baby, into a family, a large family. I had two big sisters and one big brother, and everything was going absolutely fine. Very healthy person, did really well at school. And then one day, when I was around 8 years old, my little sister was born, and I started, it just strangely coincided with my little sister being born, I started falling over and dropping things and not feeling quite myself, and I had lots of headaches and things like that. And my parents just thought, oh well, there's a new baby in the house, she must be wanting attention, craving attention. So they sort of ignored me a bit, and I thought, well, I must be making up, I must be going mad, and maybe they're right, maybe it is what's happened to me. But it gradually got worse, and to the point where I started dragging the left hand side of my body, my left leg, and then it sort of developed into movement, so my left hand side of my body was moving around on its own. And my parents obviously saw this developing and thought, actually there is something seriously wrong, and took me to the doctors. And I went to the hospital, and that was a local hospital, who said that they couldn't do anything for me there, that it was too complex, so they moved me to the city. We went to Birmingham, which is the largest city near my hometown in Staffordshire in England. And that's where I ended up for 6 weeks. I was in an isolated room. They didn't know what was wrong with me. They thought possibly I could be contagious. So I felt completely alone and ostracised from everything. I felt very much like the doctors were talking about me and not to me. I felt very, very, not part of the diagnosis whatsoever at that age. My body was moving around on its own. The left-hand side of it now was moving around. And they just didn't know what was wrong. Did lots of tests. They thought perhaps I had a brain tumour. But that was, I had an MRI scan and they said, no, that's not a brain tumour. So lots and lots and lots more tests over the 6 weeks I was in hospital. They finally discovered what was wrong and they diagnosed me with left-sided hemiplegia choreus, which is a movement disorder. It's sort of similar to epilepsy, I suppose, in a way. Visually, it looks like you're kind of moving around all the time. Your fingers are keep moving, your arm keep moving around, your leg keep moving around, but you're not in control of it. And I was pretty much paralysed on that left-hand side of the body when it wasn't moving around. So they gave me lots of medication, and I went home in a wheelchair. So my life was completely turned around. My life had completely changed at this point, and I was very, very, very depressed and down on my luck. And just wanted things to go back to normal. But my family were fantastic. And although I didn't have my friends around because I couldn't go to school, I was homeschooled for a while. They all sort of gathered around and made, like, you know, being in a wheelchair and all those negative things you think are devastating, quite fun by pushing me around in my chair and having a good laugh. And eventually I got the strength back again and the medication sort of leveled out so that my left side of my body was controlled again, but I still wasn't very well. I had these headaches and these pains still on the left side of my body, even though the movement was slightly more controlled. I wasn't quite right, I wasn't myself, and even at school I couldn't concentrate properly. I had all kinds of difficulties. And as the years went by, that sort of died down a little bit. Like, the medication seemed to be kind of okay. It wasn't so terrible, but then I started getting urine infections and something else was going wrong, and my parents didn't know what to do about that, so they took me to my neurologist. Were like, oh, there's something wrong here, so let's give you a nephrologist now. So let's go and see a kidney specialist, so see what's going on there. So I would then had another doctor, and they were like, there's definitely something wrong. And I'm sort of summarising here because many years are passing and within this picture of diagnosis, in that, you know, is there something wrong? I mean, lots of little girls have urine infections. Sometimes it's quite a common thing. It can be a common thing. They were sort of trying to figure out whether it was something else or there's something more sinister underlying. So they sent me to a psychologist, where I had a terrible, terrible experience of a psychologist sort of inferring that, you know, I was being abused by either my brother or my father or the teacher at school, where I ended up, you know, crying my eyes out in the psychologist's room and sort of racing out, you know, out of the room to my parents, and having this terrifying experience, which actually put me off counsellors or psychologists for many, many years, when I perhaps would have, you know, it would have been helpful to have had that experience. And then they found out that obviously that I nothing was going under, you know, sinister was going on. And I knew that they were doing it for the right reasons for sending me to a psychologist, but obviously there's a right and a wrong way of trying to, you know, find that out. And I had a biopsy, and they found out I had got diagnosed with a rare kidney disease called FSGS, focal segmental glomerulosclerosis, which is the scarring of the filtering unit of your kidneys, and I got put on some medication. So by this point, I'm sort of rushing ahead a little bit, but there's a lot to fit in. I was 13, and they put me on cyclophosphamide. That to me was the best medication out of all the choices I had. I thought, this is the worst side effect, the best side effects out of everything else that I could possibly have. So it meant that I lost some of my hair. My hair was falling out when I had the treatment. So I had about I don't know, 4 or 5 rounds of this treatment. So I go into the hospital, have the intravenous treatment. I'd always get it put in through my left arm so I could draw pictures with my right hand, because that's how I got through my time drawing. And then that worked, that everything worked out, and it got rid of the nephrotic syndrome. Obviously, I was still living with the disease that could come back, whether it's going to relapse or not. But it was stable after that horrendous treatment at such a sort of delicate age of 13, of that happening to me, which was absolutely devastating, going to school and having to deal with that at that age. I got through it, and then I felt a bit stronger and things were going a bit better, and I was able to go to school a bit more, and I made a really good friends again. So like, I felt like things were sort of fairly stable. You know, in the background, I was still seeing my neurologist on and off, and getting, you know, regular EEGs and MRIs. But that seemed to be quite fairly stable. And then suddenly, at about the age of 14, headaches came back. The pain in the left hand side of my body came back, but it wasn't chorea anymore. Chorea had gone, that movement disorder had gone away. And we went back to the doctor and said to the doctor that something strange is happening. I really don't feel right. And I was tired all the time, and I had that concentration problem again, and the headaches got worse. They turned into migraines, so that I was missing time from school, like just lying in bed in darkness, missing so much of that vital period of schooling. And going back to the doctor, and the doctor just really had started to stop looking for a cause. They were treating the migraines, they were trying to treat the pains, they were giving me medication after medication after medication, try this out for a few weeks, no, come off that, try this out, what about these things together. And then one day I had an MRI, and finally something showed up on the MRI scan, and the MRI scan showed that I'd had a stroke at the age of 7, which had caused the chorea. So I thought, oh well, maybe we're getting somewhere now, maybe, like, well, what's the cause of the stroke? But they didn't seem to be looking for the cause of the stroke. They were like, oh, this has happened. They were just treating it as history, and still, you know, as I said, treating the symptoms over trying to look for this cause. And, you know, now I'm into sort of GCSE year, and I'm on such high dosages of medication. I'm zombified and I can't really do anything. I just cannot do anything. I'm just completely done in all the time. The medication, like the side effects of the medication, actually get rid of the pain, but they're zombifying me, so I can't do anything. And my parents just got to the point where they were like, well, what are we going to do? Like, this isn't a life for a 15-year-old kid. It's nearly 16. So they tried to get in touch with my neurologist again. And the neurologist wasn't picking up the phone, wasn't receiving all these, you know, we left lots of messages with the secretary. And my mum and dad at the last resort said, okay, well, we'll go and see the pharmacist. By this point, I mean, you build these relationships up as a patient. We're very good friends with the pharmacist, because we're on first name terms, because we're always there. So my parents go and see the pharmacist, and he says, well, he looks at the medication. And he said, she's on a cocktail of medications. They're all fighting one another. And not only is it a cocktail, but these medications, the dosage levels are for adults, then for the age that I was at. You need to get in touch with the neurologist immediately. And, you know, she needs to be taken off this medication. No wonder she's like she is. So we've had a sort of an emergency contact with the neurologist, and I was taken back into hospital and during my GCSE year, and they took them about 6 weeks to wean me off the medication, have physio so I could get my strength back. Bear in mind, I was so weak, you know, I hadn't been doing anything, I'd just been lying down. And, you know, we were like hoping that once I'd been weaned off, that maybe they would start to try and look again, maybe with fresh eyes, like, can you get someone else to look at me? You know, what can we do? My parents and me were very frustrated. And so once I was, you know, I came out of hospital, I was a lot stronger, feeling a lot better, having been taken off the medication, but was still having the symptoms, same symptoms I was like years ago. we went in for our outpatient appointment with my neurologist, and he said, I remember it very, very vividly, him just saying, "Hello, Emily, how have you been?" And my parents are just, and me, I was just like, "My name is Sarah, and I've been treated by you since I was, 8 years old. Like, and you're calling me Emily." And that was kind of like the final straw. It was just the point where you're like, okay, that's it now. Like, I haven't got any patience anymore for this, and you're not listening and you're not helping. And look at me and see what I'm going through at this young age. My dad just, he just flipped. His temper got the better of him, and his anxiety and his stress. And he just said, we don't want you as a doctor anymore. We want a referral to the best hospital in the country." And that happens to be Great Ormond Street. I'm sure everyone knows Great Ormond Street is the best paediatric hospital in the country and one of the best in the world. And he was like, "Well, okay, then you can go. I'll send you there then." And his assistant was very upset, and I remember her standing up and saying, "You can't speak to the doctor like that, you know." And he was like, "Well, actually, if you understood what we'd been through, then I think that's completely legitimate. To, if we have to get to this point, then it's fair." So I was referred to Great Ormond Street, and they treated the case with completely fresh eyes, and they redid all the tests that I'd had over the years and more. And they were like, "Well, we're going to try, we're going to look at this, and we're going to find a cause, and we're going to not just treat the symptoms. We're not going to just keep piling on medication after medication." And they gave me an angiogram, which we kind of remember that being the sort of final test after MRIs and more EEGs and all the usuals. They gave me an angiogram, and I remember, going in, it happening, and having a fairly poor experience. Actually, that was the one poor experience I had at Great Ormond Street, in that they did not explain the procedure to me at all. It's quite a funny bit in the book, I think, if you're interested in reading the in-depth. I go in for the angiogram, I'm in a gown, and then I wake up, and they haven't explained what was going to happen, and they put me to sleep because I was the age I was at the time. I think these days, if you're an adult, you're normally awake when you have an angiogram. And I woke up, and I had no underwear on. And I went in with underwear on. I didn't know that they were going to like be injecting in my groin, or that I'd feel bruised there. And I woke up, and I was just like, "Oh my God, like, where is all my stuff? And like, what happened to me?" Like, no one had really explained anything. She's completely mad now if I really think about it. I remember saying to the nurse, my dad was sat there with me, and I was saying to the nurse, and bear in mind, I'm 17 at this point, 17 years old. The nurse, "Where are my pants? Like, where are my underpants?" And she just picked them up, but she had them in a see-through envelope, and she just showed them in front of my dad to my face. She was like, "Oh, here they are," and explained what had happened. And I was just like very, very sort of matter of fact and straight to me. And I was just like, "If you just explained this to me earlier." And it's so embarrassing, like my pants being shown in the, and anyway, it was that aside, after that, obviously everything was rather wonderful, because I remember actually having a better weekend. That this is the weekend before it was all revealed, but I was feeling a bit healthier, feeling a bit better, a bit stronger. I hadn't had any migraines that week, and I went to a music festival for one night, which was really like a really big thing, because I didn't really normally, my parents wouldn't really normally let me out of their sight because I was so unwell. And I went to this music festival, and I'd had a really wonderful time, and I came home on a bit of a high, thinking, "Oh, that was an amazing experience." And my mum was like, "I need to speak to you and sit you downstairs, and once you've had a wash and got clean after this muddy festival." And I sat in the lounge, and she said, "The doctor's phoned, and they found out what's wrong with you." And I remember being really mad, because I would have wanted her to have like phoned me at the festival and told me immediately as soon as she'd known. But obviously, like, she wanted me to have a nice time and like escape this, not be the illness for a little bit, because that's how you end up feeling when you're that ill and you've been experiencing something for so long. And I remember sitting in the lounge with her, and she said, "They've diagnosed you with moyamoya, which I thought was a really mad sounding disease, and I'd never heard of anything like that. And she said it's very rare. It affects 1 in 1 million people in the UK. And I was like, okay. And she said, and they might be able to help you. They've offered you an opportunity to have surgery, brain surgery, which may mean that you won't have to live with these horrible migraines anymore or this illness. And she explained to me that what moyamoya was, which is when you're born with blood vessels that are very, very tiny, and they cause blockages in your brain, so obviously causing stroke. And what I'd been having all these years was sort of TIAs and strokes. Well, I had the one big stroke, but I'd been having little mini strokes all this time, and that, which is why I was so unwell. And what had happened when I was young, which is why I had the career, was that I was born with moyamoya. I'd had a stroke at the age of 7, which had caused the career. So everything suddenly made sense in the world. And it, I can't explain how incredible it is to have been ill for 10 years of your life and not know what's wrong with you, and often thinking that you're completely mad. And the doctor's not, you know, you get to a point where the doctor's just trying to feed you medication and not looking for a cause. You do think that maybe it's all in your mind and that you're making it up, and that may, you know, you do have those moments where you start questioning yourself. And like when you have a good day, you think, oh, I must have been making it up when I wasn't very well the other day because I've had a good day today or whatever. Like it starts making you question those things. And so finally having that diagnosis, having a name for something, and then being told that there's a potential operation you could have, and but the choice was mine whether to have it. But obviously if I didn't have it, I would have been continued to be at risk of having another major stroke. And that was my decision to make. And I remember talking to all my family. As I say, I had a very support, I still do have a very supportive family, and everyone has their own approach. And my brother is very musical, and he started playing on the piano and making up a song about moyamoya to me, which was very funny. You know, he has sort of the lighter, humorous side of things, and whereas my sisters were more sort of like empathetic and sort of, you know, weighing up pros and cons and so on. And then I decided to do it. So I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to have the surgery, because my life as it was then was, to me, just was so difficult. And I was like, if there's a smidgen of a chance that I can have a better life and go on to do what I want to do, which at that time, the only thing that meant anything to me was drawing and art. And I wanted to go to a really good university that wasn't in my local town. I wanted to go to south and down south in England and go to a very good university. That was my sort of dream. I was like, well, if that means that I can live this dream that I want, then I'm going to go for it and do it and be brave. And it was the first thing, you know, when you think about being, you know, the sort of first big things you do when you're an adult, they're normally like the biggest thing might be like learning to drive, right? Well, for me, it was signing a form in the hospital that I was allowing them to perform brain surgery, which was like a huge deal because it was like on my back. I was like, yeah, yeah, sure. I know the risks. I can do this. So that was pretty extreme. But, you know, it felt kind of like, well, if I can do this, I can probably do anything in life. So, you know, I did it. And I went to Great Ormond Street, being the oldest patient I think they had in the hospital, because I wasn't really supposed to be there anymore, but it had taken so long. I was 18 years old going in for brain surgery. And I remember sitting there in the morning waiting for the trolley to come and just drawing my surroundings, drawing all the nurses and the doctors and everything, and giving them the drawing and saying to them something ridiculous like, well, if I die, you know, in the operating table, then you've got this, it'll be worth loads. And going down and, you know, like 7 hours later or something, it was something crazy like that, 6 or 7 hours of surgery, waking up. And just waking up knowing that I was who I still, you know, it was still me. I was like, well, it might not have worked, it might have worked, it might not have worked, but I still feel like me and I'm still Sarah. So that's great. And then obviously, you know, well, not obviously, but it was a success. And I still go to see my neurologist regularly. and I still episodically have some moments where I suffer with migraines. But I mean, I'm talking when I was younger, this was like at least, it was every month I was having these episodes. So like sometimes 2 weeks on the trot every day with extreme pain. So I mean, to have the operation and to live the life that I've led so far since then, I'm, you know, incredibly grateful that that hospital, I'm grateful for my parents for forcing this to happen, to go to the good hospital, to get to Ormond Street and to get those fresh eyes on my case. But also to obviously the surgeons for making me better. And you know, there's always still that, you know, you live with a progressive disease, which is what Moyamoya is, there's always the risk of it coming back. But I go regularly to the hospital and get regular checked in and MRIs, etc. And then with my kidney disease, I'm always living with the chance of relapse. So I had a relapse back in September, which has been very, very difficult during the pandemic. And I only recently moved. I moved to Scotland, and so I had a new. As soon as I got here, I got sick again, and so it was like, oh, I'm meeting a brand new doctor. I've moved to a brand new place, and then got ill again, which is a bit frustrating. But so far, I've had a fantastic experience here in Scotland, and I can't fault my doctors of how they've taken care of me over this mad pandemic period. So I'm just coming out of that now, but it's a lot to take in. That's my whole story. I hope that wasn't too much of a rushed summary. But yeah. Oh, I think you're on mute, Leah.
I didn't even realize I was on mute, but that was perfect. That was perfect, Sarah. Everything that you told me, how you went into the diagnosis, how you ended up finally a diagnosis. That was incredible what you went through and your parents. I'm so grateful. This is why parents and advocates are so extremely important, because sometimes when patients cannot advocate for themselves, we need our support system to be there. Yeah. And I'm incredibly sorry that you had to go through such experiences growing up, but I feel like you are such a more, much more amazing person today because of what you went through. And it's definitely paved you into the person that you are. So thank you so much for sharing that with me. So Sarah, I have a few questions for you now. And I'll start off with the first one is that, what matters to you when interacting with health professionals and undergoing invasive examinations? What matters to you the most?
I think my overriding feeling towards is, and I think we all have different, very varying experiences with different doctors, is that you want to feel like the practitioners are treating you like a human being. And I think sometimes, especially when you're a rare person like me, the owner of two rare diseases, particularly Moyamoya, I think sometimes you can end up feeling a little bit like a specimen and a number, and that they're excited about the disease more than they are, and like you being sort of research in a way, than they are about actually asking you, how are you coping in your life? Like, how is this affecting you personally? And I think, you know, sometimes you can sit there and they throw statistics at you, or like, you're like, what? Can you like tell me exactly like the human side of things? And I kind of had a little bit of experience of like that recently, because I was on very high dosages of prednisolone for the first time in my life to fight my recent relapse, and no one really told me exactly how it would affect daily life so much, you know, like how invasive it was and how it changed my whole, like, you know, my big moon face. I had this big moon face. I can laugh about it now, but and how it it changes so much, and your mental state as well, and it's really intrusive. And it was kind of like, I suppose sometimes doctors get so used to prescribing things and just going, and then that's how we're going to get rid of it, and it's very, very sort of more matter of fact. And don't realise how difficult, you know, the daily life of that is, and how that affects everything, every part of you. And sometimes you kind of just want them to slow down a bit and talk about that potential things, side effects, etc. And again, with, you know, I talk about my experience of having an angiogram and nothing being told to me and waking up and not knowing what happened. It's so vital when you're going to have procedures or tests or whatever to have that explained to you before you go in. I mean, to me, that's just common sense. And I'm still surprised at how little I was told before I went into that procedure. And since then, I have to say my own experiences of varying procedures have been, you know, much, much better. But yeah, the importance of those things, of explaining things and the human side of it. And I think bedside manner, that should be a flipping module at medical school. It really should. Like, but how do you talk to your patients? And I have to say, in my experience, that I've always found neurologists are the worst at communicating compared to my nephrologist. I don't know if that's a common thing or just my experience, but I've always really got on really well with my renal specialists, and I've always had more difficulty with my neurologists. Yeah.
I definitely agree with you, Sarah, that the aspect of humanism needs to come back. And I cannot understand how at the age that you were 17, they did not provide you with instructions or general knowledge about this procedure, which today would be really outrageous, because they're supposed to, and it's part of the process of providing consent for the surgery. So my next question kind of paves way is, how can patients ensure that they feel respected, heard, and understood, and that providers actually listen to them?
I think sometimes you need to, it's very difficult, because I think often when you're in these positions, you go into clinic and you're speaking to a doctor, and you can often feel very overwhelmed because, you know, whatever, you were anxious or whatever, or however you're feeling, because of your current situation, it can be incredibly difficult to feel confident enough to say, okay, this is how I want things to go. But I think it's really important, like, for me, like with my kidney disease, it's a lot worse now than it was when I was younger, and this steroid treatment sort of really progressed the disease, like knocked my function a lot. So I'm down to about 25% now or something. And that's quite frightening. And obviously, like, you kind of want to know what the future is with your illness. But for me, I kind of want to do it at a slower pace. So for me, it's kind of like, I like to go in and say to the doctor, I want to know what the next step is, but I don't want to know the end, you know, what the step after that is, because I want to pace it out from that. I think it's very much about sort of telling your specialist immediately, like, how you want to be, how much information you want, and I think that's perfectly fine. Like, if you want to know way ahead and you want all the information, and that and that's how you manage things, and that's how you deal with things, and how you cope with living with illness, that's fine. But for me, like, I had to sort of say this to my specialist, because they kept saying, well, this could happen and that could happen because you had this treatment before. And I was like, you're giving me too much to handle, and I'm overwhelmed, and I need you to just, like, give me chunks at a time that I can cope with, that I can manage. And what I need to know now, not what I need to know in 2 years, or, you know. And I think sometimes it's very common for specialists or doctors to tell you every eventuality, every possibility, and overwhelm you with information, and you're sat there and you're just like, oh my God, I'm dying. and it's really not that bad. But, like, I think sometimes, like, that information, the statistics, is it's on the tip of their tongue, so they just reel it off. And to them, it's not, like, they're like, you're nowhere near, like, this bad, but I'm going to give you all this information anyway. And to them, it's not, they're so immune to these statistics and this or data that they're spilling out, because it's a daily event for them, and it's not their body.
I'm sure if they were giving the information to their mom or their sister or something, they probably would be more responsible with the language. I think maybe that is that the right thing to say? It's a
They'd have this
responsibility.
emotional connection to it, definitely. I feel that's
Yeah.
it's very true what you've said, Sarah, that there's this kind of disconnect where, because providers and clinicians have been so busy seeing patients and seeing patients more like a specimen instead of actually taking the time to sit down and asking the patient, what is it do you need? How can I help you? What are your symptoms? Is there anything? Instead of resorting to, say, prescriptions first, if you took the time to listen, I feel it would be a very different story. And I love that you mentioned that patients should decide how much information they want to receive and inform the provider and the physician that they want to know about the next step, but not two steps down the lane, or statistics that are not relevant to the situation are not necessarily needed to be told. So these are very crucial points you've highlighted. And this paves way into our next question, Sarah, which is kind of a loaded question, but what is one thing that you believe can be done to improve the healthcare system?
Ooh, that's a one thing. Oh gosh, that's a tough one. If for my particular experience, I think it is about we're talking about diagnosis, I suppose. I'm going to focus on that. I'm going to try and restrict it. Is don't stop looking for a cause, and and get distracted by symptoms. I think it's like I'll because I mean, in my experience, it's absolutely devastating when I went back. So as I say, I wrote a graphic novel about my experience and did a lot of my own research, so I went back and spoke to my old doctors. And so I call the doctor Dr. W. I'm not going to give you his full name. The W is the one that misdiagnosed me for years, and we left and transferred. I asked him if he had heard of Moya Moya, and he said yes. He'd actually diagnosed four kids before he met me with it, but that I didn't represent as a usual case of Moya Moya. I wasn't having loads of strokes. I'd had one, and then I was having TIAs, and it was all kind of sort of a mishmash. And he sort of got distracted by the kidney disease and tried to link those things, and got very, very lost with it, I think. But he said to me if he'd just done one test. He'd been given me an angiogram at the age of about 10 years old, which he would have been able to do. They would have seen that I had Moya Moya, and they would have diagnosed me, and I would have been able to have the operation at 10 years old. So I would have had 8 years back of my health. So I guess when I'm saying like, don't stop looking for the cause and repeat tests, I think. Like, I just think, when I think back by my little self, and I think if I could talk to her, and I think when you find out things like that, you end up reflecting on all the missed opportunities you had, and when you had an opportunity and then you couldn't go because you got sick, and then you think, and if you'd just done that one test, if that doctor had just done that. And sometimes it takes a lot to I'm going off the question a bit now, but I think it took a lot to forgive that, I think. And we all make mistakes and we're all human. And I guess I started to see his human side, and he apologized to me. And I know that, doctors aren't doctors without like wanting to, diagnose and cure or help people, take away their pain. I know that he wouldn't have gone out of his way to not diagnose me. It wasn't that, but it's difficult, isn't it? Like when you just think when you get that information. And so that would be my one underlying thing would be, and I think perhaps it's done more now. And maybe it was a very much like of the time, but second opinion, speak to your colleagues. If you're getting stuck, don't just try and think, oh, well, I've got to fix this myself because this is my patient. And I think that, what's really good about the profession these days is that I do feel like there's more of a feeling of community within doctors, and everyone sort of knows each other and will speak to each other if you've got a good provider. And I'm not saying that it's always the case because, I know people really have that problem with their doctors trying to communicate with one another and wanting to have perhaps a number of doctors in there. In clinic, if they've got a number of things wrong with them, I've got lots of things, different things wrong with me. That sometimes you'd like, it would be great if I could have them all in one room and like we could have a nice chat. So yeah, it's about communication as well.
Perfect. And then my last question for you, Sarah, is that if there's anyone wanting to share their story and too afraid to maybe share their story, what would you say to them? And how did you cope with your diagnosis growing up?
My diagnosis growing up, I mean, it was very, very, I have to say, my family got me through everything. And I'm very, very lucky because I know that everybody would necessarily have that kind of supportive family. What is brilliant now is that there are many, many like communities out there. And, me being someone with a rare disease, there are like, I speak to people all around the world now. Like in the 90s when I was growing up, we didn't have the internet, so we couldn't like my parents couldn't speak to someone else either side of the world who has a daughter with Moya Moya, or it's more common in Japan, so they couldn't go and speak to someone in Japan, or it's more common in America actually as well. So there are like I would say like have the confidence to go and join any community, even if it's not necessarily specific to your disease. So obviously I have quite a rare disease, but there are loads of like rare disease communities out there. So I do a lot of work with Medics for Rare Diseases in the UK. With Dr. Lucy McKay as the CEO. And there's also like don't I guess a lot of people, the instinct is once you get a diagnosis, or maybe if you're undiagnosed, your instinct is to sort of hide away from your illness and pretend it's not there, or if maybe you get better and then you don't want to sort of embrace your past. And I think what I've learned is that I feel better about living with my illnesses. Now I've actually accepted them a bit more and stopped pushing them away and speak out and tell my story. And it is hard to do that. And it takes a lot of confidence to stand in front of a medical conference or which I do a lot of and speak about what's happened to me. Also, just bear in mind, you know more about your illness than anybody. And so you are, you know more than anybody, but you live with it. And so everything you're saying is true, and you should feel confident and speaking out. And also, by sharing those experiences, not only are you helping doctors and other medical practitioners to understand what it's like to live with it, which hopefully in turn means that they have a more human. We're talking about the humanity, so, of it, that they have more of an understanding in that way. But also, it helps other people who may feel very isolated and alone living with whatever condition they're living with. And when I think back to myself as a little kid and being very, very shy and not wanting to speak out or talk to even other kids on my ward or anything. That was very, very hard. And that's why I made the book I made, because I thought about myself, I was like, well, maybe if I didn't want to speak to a community group because I was a bit shy or like in person, if I can make this book that's visual, that doesn't take enormous, it's not like reading a big long essay when you don't feel very well, it's a visual piece that you can read through and live that experience of what I experienced and see that there is hope and that, if you do challenge the system, it can work for you. Not that we should have to do that, but then we can learn from it. Then those people won't feel so alone. And what was surprising, I suppose, about speaking out and making this book was the amount of practitioners that did get in touch with me and said, "You've changed the way I view my patients." Isn't that amazing? Like, even I had one particular email that really touched me. From an anaesthetist, And she said she, because I spoke on BBC Radio quite a lot here in the UK when my book came out, and she said, "I heard you on the radio. I went and bought your book. I read it in one sitting, and I had to email you because I've become immune, like I was saying about being becoming immune to your environment and what it is like being a patient." She said, "It made me realise like what it must be like for my patients." And now I'm going to go into work every day, and I'll try and remember your story every time I go in, because I need to have more empathy than I've had in the past few years. And I think, you know, if it's been more than one person, but I just think if I can have that effect on one person, wow, that's amazing. Like, so yeah, tell your story, share your stories, and you do have a voice, and your voice is really valuable to other patients as well as practitioners.
You so beautifully put it, Sarah. I don't know how to thank you for summarizing it and bringing every and all concepts. I'm gonna encourage all listeners to please go and buy Sarah's novel to read it and take the time, because it's really an eye-opener. And with this, Sarah, we hope that the Behind Diagnosis Patient Special series sheds light on the importance of listening to patient voices, and that over time it will increase patient safety, health innovation, can transform care delivery in the clinic and beyond. So, Sarah, thank you so much from the bottom of my heart for coming onto the PureMed podcast and for sharing your beautiful story and your experiences, insights, and the world of knowledge that you've gained over time.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'd like to thank our sponsors, Hashtag Rising Youth, the Government of Canada, Canada Service Corps, and Taking It Global for supporting and funding the project. I'd also like to thank the incredible individuals, voices, and patients who appear on the series, and whose stories will guide medical education, clinical practice, and healthcare innovation. Listen in and listen now to the Behind Diagnoses Patient Special series on the PureMed podcast to ensure change for a better world. Catch us on the next episode in conversation with another incredible patient advocate. And if you need more information, do not hesitate to email us at pyramedfoundation@gmail.com. Thank you for tuning in. Stay safe, stay healthy.